I think there are probably three lines of operation for the federal government here. One is the continued response that's being carried out under Paul Zumkopf, the two-star admiral that is leading the Unified Area Command in New Orleans, and that's making sure the oil is out of the marshes to the extent that it can be, the beaches are clean, and that we move to a transition where we actually agree with the local leaders on how clean is clean and when the job is done. That's one. The second is something called a natural resource damage assessment that is required by law. And that is an assessment that's carried out jointly by the Department of Commerce and the Department of Interior, who are the federal trustees exactly, to determine what damage was done, what the extent of the injury is, and what should be done to repair the damage. And again, BP as a responsible party will be responsible to pay for that. The third line of effort was just established last week with the issuance of Secretary Mabus's report and the stand-up of an ecosystem task force that will be headed by EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson to look at the long-term recovery issues associated with the Gulf.
What were some of the biggest challenges of getting this job done from a federal government perspective?
Well, aside from the technical issues associated with controlling the well and oil recovery,
yeah.
I would say the single largest issue, and it is in any crisis, is unity of effort and taking together the combined resources, capabilities, and competencies of the various departments and agencies and understanding their authorities, jurisdictions, and knitting that all together to create a whole-of-government response that doesn't disenfranchise anybody. And that's an enormous effort. We don't have the monolithic unity of command that you see in DOD, so what you try and strive for is unity of effort.
And you had federal, state, local. You had multiple states involved and multiple agencies involved. How did you get everyone going in the same direction?
Well, first of all, you got to get agreement on the goals and what it is you're trying to accomplish, and then you have to make the means and the ends of that as transparent as you can so everybody understands what is being done. I think one of the huge challenges associated with this response was that BP was carrying out the responsibilities that we had directed them to in accordance with their role as a responsible party. But because of the way the procurement system works and everything else, because there was no visibility of what was going on, there were a lot of inferences made about whether or not they were doing the right thing, whether or not they were subordinating corporate goals to cleaning the environment. And I think the general lack of transparency and opaqueness of all the processes that were involved would lead the public to believe that maybe not everything was being done that could be done, or questioning motives. And I think that's a huge challenge.
And one of the interesting parts of all this was, in a way, there was almost so much transparency that we got different. It seemed like every week we got a different flow rate coming out. And so I think it led Joe or Joanna Public to think that, oh my goodness, they don't know what's going on. Almost, was there too much transparency in some way?
Well, I would give you two responses to that. I told one reporter, in fact, I told several, if you don't have a number, it's a credibility issue. If you have a number, it's a credibility issue.
Yeah.
And I think that has to do with the extensive media coverage. But in regard to your statement, I don't think there's ever going to be a major crisis in this country in the future, whether it's a tsunami, an earthquake, a hurricane, devastating wildfires or anything, where there won't be complete public participation in what's going on, either because of the media that are involved, non-governmental organizations, people using social media, and anybody that's going to be running one of these large responses and trying to create unity of effort across the government is going to have to understand the public is going to participate, and you need to make allowances for that and make it easier for them to do it, because they're going to do it whether you can do it or not, and they can get access to where you're at. They can be on the web, and it's just a part and a feature of these responses moving forward.
And it seems in some way this was really the first disaster in this social media world, where you did have everyone wanting to know. They wanted to they almost wanted the direct feed. Well, you did post the direct feed of the oil coming out and people making their own assessments. Did that help you do your job, or did that distract you from doing your job?
Well, whether it helps you or distracts you, it's
the fact of life.
Deal with. In fact, I said to one of my staff at the end of this cycle, before we were ready to transfer a lot of our functions down to the local regional commander, that managing one of these crises, large scale across government, with what you have to do, it takes on almost the semblance of sometimes a reality show. And I don't know how you do away with that, but you certainly have to account for it.
Yeah. Did you? It seemed like you were out almost, you know, they always say communicate, 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 and then communicate some more. It certainly seemed like you used this as an opportunity to, wherever you could, speak and talk to folks about what you knew at that point in time.
Well, I think it's very important that any federal response have a face of the response and a point of accountability, and to understand where government is going and trying to lead the effort. And I think that's always going to be important. I think also that there's almost a responsibility or a duty to whoever is managing one of these responses to put as much information out as possible. People understand that there are difficult problems to be solved, and they understand that there are certain things you can't control. And I think sometimes just saying this is a very hard problem and this is what we're doing about it kind of reinforces the notion that it is large and complex, but people are on task.
Yeah. It seemed during periods of time that it was that so much of the expertise really was amongst oil companies that almost the government didn't have the kind of people. And so you were therefore dependent on BP or other expertise amongst oil companies. Is that perception or is that fact?
Well, it's a little bit of both. And I would separate controlling the well from the rest of the response and give you a two-part answer.
Mm-hmm.
In controlling the well, in other words, containing the oil flow and then shutting it in, the technology to do that and the expertise to actually manage that well from an engineering standpoint resided in the private sector. That caused a little bit of a concern because I think a lot of people were questioning whether or not there was a relevant role for government. Well, first of all, the government has the duty to oversee this response and make sure it's done properly. And in this case, the oversight of how the well was actually controlled actually came about through the science team that was stood up by Secretary Salazar and headed by Secretary Chu, the Secretary of Energy, which brought people in from the national labs with engineering backgrounds to review what BP was doing and ask some really hard questions. So at the wellhead, that became the government's role, even though they didn't own the means of production, if you will. Mm-hmm. On the oil spill response, we decided in 1990 with the passage of the Oil Pollution Act of 1990 that we would privatize oil spill response and make an industry out of that, and they're called oil spill response organizations. And the plans that are laid out for a response to an oil spill identify which firms and which contractors will bring resources to the scene. So in that respect, we had made a conscious decision, a public policy decision, that the private sector would be the place where we would source spill response equipment and spill response organizations. And I think moving forward, if there's a question about control and oversight, it probably has to do with how we're going to manage the private sector response to one of these things, because the actual implementation will be through contractors with oversight being conducted by the federal government. And I don't think that was well understood by the American public either.
That's a unique skill set, almost a very different skill set than actually going out and getting the job done.
It is, and it's very different from natural disaster response, in which you have a request for an emergency declaration or a disaster declaration, which the president issues, and then that provides resources to state and local authorities who then execute the response themselves. In an oil spill, there's a presumption of federal preeminence, if you will, or overriding federal authority, because it involves interstate commerce, waterways, and beyond state jurisdictions, and that's very hard for state and local political leaders to understand that the actual execution and the tactical direction of this thing is not in their hands.
As a career federal person, well, now a retired federal person, but as somebody who's worked as a career person for most of your life, politics, we all know that politics plays a role in this town, and oftentimes the career folks sort of fly below that radar screen. They're impacted by it, but they're just looking to get their jobs done day to day. In this particular case, where an administration was seeing its poll ratings sinking day by day as the oil spill was going on, it has to be hard to maneuver amongst that a lot of landmines there.
Well, I think we need to understand that any major event in the future in this country, as I said earlier, whether it's an earthquake or a tsunami, a hurricane or whatever, is going to be as much a political event as it is an operational event. You can't operate independent of the political context, and to paraphrase Tip O'Neill, all oil spills are local. And I think government career folks that have been involved in this line of work for a long, long time just need to understand that the more senior you get, you're going to have to learn how to be effective in a political environment without being political. And by political, I mean partisan.
Right.
And I think that's a challenge for all of us. And I've actually counseled the junior folks working for me for many, many years that that's the key to working in Washington.
Yeah, it's and being able to maneuver. I sometimes sort of quietly laugh at people who say, I don't play politics. And I'm like, well, yeah, you do, or else it seems like you're not able to really get your job done in an effective way.
Well, the political apparatus is the means by which the budget is acted upon in this town, and anybody that says they don't act in a political environment either doesn't work in Washington or doesn't spend money.
So you've had You've had all of a couple days to sit back and reflect on this a little bit. Are there, and I'm not saying are there things that you would do otherwise, but are there broad lessons that folks who are all watching this and going there, but for the grace of God, if I had to deal with that, how would I do it? Are there lessons that you're pulling from this that can be learned, that other agencies can learn from this event?
Well, as I said earlier, the enduring challenge is always going to be when you're dealing with a large event that's not under the control of the Department of Defense or the Department of Justice for a criminal investigation, is going to be creating unity of effort. And it's an extraordinary challenge the more complex that the problem becomes. And I think that's the resident challenge moving forward, and how we create the ability in government to do that and achieve what's expected by the public. I think there may be a diverging area between the expectations of the public for a whole of government response and what the authorities and legislation actually allows you to do and what the appropriations allow you to do, and they're not always the same. And I think trying to manage that gap is always going to be a significant challenge, and I think in some cases it may be growing.
And one of the aspects of it that just fascinated me was this expertise. I've seen you speak before, and you talk about getting the right people in the right place at the right time, doing the right job. In this case, you know, there were pockets of expertise, either in industry or in academia, being able to get those people in the right place at the right time seemed like a very, very big challenge. And then trusting the information that they have, because if they're in industry, they're almost suspect.
And we have a lot of rules that actually restrict that, and things like the Federal Advisory Committee Act, sunshine laws, and all that kind of stuff that don't really become very functional in a response where timeliness is of the essence. Yeah. You're trying to produce effects out there. And I think moving forward, what we really have to talk about is, in my view, is a national doctrine, so that when we have one of these events, no matter what it is, we can have the same expectation about how we're going to organize, identify the problem, establish who's got the lead and who supports, and very much the same way they would do it in DOD, but it's a much easier challenge for them because it's entirely within one department and one chain of command.
And was there something about, I mean, was there a situation where you weren't able to get the right people at some point in time that you really needed to?
Well, sometimes you have to create a new paradigm.
Right.
One of the great success stories that came out of this, and we probably did it too late in my view, was taking control of the airspace in the Gulf of Mexico. We had 8 near mid-air collisions in the first 6 or 7 weeks of this event. We had helicopters running logistics out to the oil rigs. We had spotter planes and helicopters. We had surveillance. We had science planes out there flying to get data. And we had the states were flying their aircraft out there. I had talked to the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, General Norty Schwartz, and I talked to Sandy Winnefeld, the U.S. Northern Commander, and I actually had a conversation with the President about taking control of the airspace, and that became pivotal in being able to organize surveillance and be able to pass information down on where the oil was so we could actually respond to it. But we actually did that through the 1st Air Force at Tyndall Air Force Base, and what they did was they replicated the same doctrine and operating procedures they used to take control of the airspace in Haiti after the earthquake to provide the landing slots to optimize the support down there. So I think we can learn and evolve doctrine, and where we can, we've got to figure out a way to replicate that in successive events.
In these kinds of media environment, oftentimes what ends up ending up on people's, either in people's newspapers or on TV, it differs from what you're in the front lines and you're going, hold on, that's not what's happening. Is there some misconception that the public, you feel, has about the work that was done?
Well, I think there are a couple, and I think that's what we have to address going forward. Number one, I don't think there's a real good understanding of the concept of the responsible party and the role that BP was supposed to play by law and what they did do. I think in general the American public believes that it seems strange that the entity that caused the problem will be part of the solution in the recovery. And
right.
The second thing is, I think, suspicion regarding whatever fiduciary responsibility that BP would have to their shareholders and legal requirements they have for them might be something that would subordinate the interests of the environmental response. And I think you have to work through that. You have to make it completely transparent what's going on, and to the extent that things are actually going right, make that clear. And I think leaders have to put that information out there, because if you don't, there'll be a void out there that'll be filled by somebody, social media or someplace. So you need to actively and proactively and affirmatively try and explain what's going on and get it out to as many people as you can so they can understand it.
Finally, before we started, I asked you, you're doing this, and when we saw each other at the Sammys, you said you were going to take some time off, but you are taking some time off. What are you doing now?
Well, I'm affiliated with RAND. I think the title Senior Fellow. That's not a full-time position. it allows you a chance to sit around and tell some C stories and talk to some very smart people about some problems that are going on in this country, but at a much more leisurely pace. And I'll be doing some speaking and some writing, but most of it at a pace where, by comparison to what I've been doing, it appears to be time off.
And what are the problems that you find fascinating these days that are an interesting challenge?
Well, some of the same problems we were working when I was a commandant. I think issues regarding where we're going with the evolution of the intelligence community under the Director of National Intelligence, how that might relate to border security and the issues we're having with Mexico, maritime flow of narcotics, issues with maritime security. We were working a lot of issues before I left the service regarding piracy off the Horn of Africa and implications for shipping, issues in the Arctic. Issues of climate change, and of course, you know, issues about oil spill response up there as well. There's a host of issues out there.